Well, hey, everyone, and welcome to the Ridge YA podcast. This is a podcast from Ridge Church, all about what it looks like to follow Jesus in the midst of the season that we're living in as a young adult. I'm Dan. I'm the pastor of youth and young adults here, and we want to welcome you to today's episode. All right, everyone. Today we have Ajay joining us. Ajay is a good friend of mine. We've known each other for a lot of years. He is a registered clinical counselor here in the Lower Mainland. He works out of Lavender Counseling, and we are so excited to have him joining us today. Ajay, how are you today?
Dan, it is good to hear you. I'm well. Yeah, it's been a sunny day today, which in the Lower Mainland means it's just going to be a great day.
So true. So true. And can you tell us a little bit? I've known you for a long time. Jaleesa and I have known you for a very long time. But would you share with our listeners just a little bit about who you are, where you're from, some of your background, and how you kind of got into what you do in terms of being a registered clinical counselor?
Yeah. I've known Jaleesa for a long time because I grew up in Salmon Arm. So we grew up going to church together. But after, I guess, the Salmon Arm phase, I moved to Langley and went to Trinity Western and got my bachelor's in psychology there. And then I think through my time at Trinity, through learning more about who I am, like student leadership, and kind of discovering that I really like being with and sitting with people, I went back to Trinity to get my master's in counseling psychology. So I graduated from there 2019 and have been working with university students at Trinity's counseling site there. But I spend most of my time at Lavender Counseling, which is a private practice in Langley. And yeah, I don't know if there's more.
More
I need to say.
All right. And so that's a little bit of your story in terms of the practical element. But would you mind diving a little bit into kind of originally what drew you to the field of counseling originally, and kind of how have you formed why it's important in the context of even faith, spirituality in the church?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Whenever I consider this, my immediate response is like, oh, I really wanted to be a counselor. I wanted to be a drummer. I feel like for me and you, Dan, maybe we should have just started a Rise Against cover band at camp. and that's where we should have been. But I remember going to some youth conference where I got to meet like one of my heroes who's a lead singer of a band. And he said something that like stuck with me. He said, like, a calling isn't something you choose. Like, it's something that chooses you. It calls you. And then he said, that's why it's called the calling. And then he walked away. And I'm like, you're so cool. but that really stuck with me throughout my time at university, in that I think I just discovered and noticed that people found it really easy to talk to me. Like, I'd have strangers message me and be like, hey, can I talk to you? And then we'd just sit and talk. And I was like, I feel like this should be weird, but I don't feel like it's weird and they don't feel like it's weird. And I just loved encountering people as they really are. I think like ever since I was a kid, I'd be asking myself questions about what it means to be a person, what it means to be in the world. And the world of psychology and counseling like explores that deeply. So the selfish part of me in counseling is that I just get to help people explore those questions and I get to walk with them through it. And because I'm their counselor, our relationship and the dynamic about it means that they just get to be fully authentically themselves. And that's actually my job. I just get to help people authentically be themselves. And I love that. But why counseling is important and how it relates to faith is, I remember one of my professors once said, like, he was talking about a verse in John 10:10, and he said, like, in the verse, like, Jesus says, like, I came to give life to the full. And he broke down the word life in the Greek, talking about, like, it wasn't the word bios, about biology. It was about, like, this, like, deep spiritual life. And he said, like, Jesus showed up to be fully human, to like discover who you are in your essence and to live in that. And and then essentially to experience love. And I think my first day of grad school, one of my favorite profs said this, and I think it's been like my mantra through counseling. And she said that like counseling is about unlearning the ways and the patterns we were taught that were necessary or needed for us to be loved. And that I think it's those two pieces together of like people want to be authentically and fully themselves, but have learned somewhere along the way that they need to be something, they need to be more than who they are to be loved. And I think counseling for me, for other people, is to help them live their life to the full, to like fully and freely experience their like mental and emotional state, to come closer to their relationship with life, with others, to themselves and to the world. And that's something that's actually quite hard for people to do if those pieces haven't been taught or shown to them. And it's easy to get stuck. And so counseling is about getting unstuck. And those are the pieces that I think really motivate me to do my job.
So what I'm hearing you saying is almost that it's something that is beneficial regardless of where you're at and maybe what your story is. Because totally. I think traditionally what I hear and understand counseling is it's for messed up people, right? It's for the people who their life's a mess or this is going wrong or that's going wrong or they're in crisis. That's when you go to a counselor. And can you maybe speak to like maybe – I don't know if stigma is the right word, but totally. What that thing is that makes us look at counseling, therapy, that kind of thing is something that people who can't handle life on their own need.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. There's this idea that, like you said, therapy is for people who are not doing well. And the goal of therapy is like take someone who's bottoming out and bring them up to normal. But it can be way more than that. And oftentimes it's to help people thrive in life. So you could be someone struggling with depression for 5 years or feel like your life is going really well and all of the pieces feel great, but you just feel a little bit stuck or life doesn't feel as fulfilling. I see both of those people in my practice all the time. And I mean, stigma comes up for so many different, it comes up in a bunch of different ways. I think there's two main pieces that I want to touch on that are related to trust. But even before that, like culturally, there can be a stigma of it, depending on what culture you grew up in, but even like your generational culture, like a lot of research shows that people over the age of 35 right now would be a little bit more resistant to counseling because mental health wasn't something that they were told is very important. Right. But likely those under the age of 20 or in their early 20s would be more open to counseling because that's something that's being emphasized a little bit more in our culture, which I think is a really good dynamic. When you say stigma, do you mean like stigma at large? Do you mean more so like stigma about what that looks like in the church?
Yeah, I think stigma at large, but also specifically in the church as it pertains to, you know, what, and maybe even you could speak to this, like at what point is counseling the right thing to do? Is it something I should just totally. Go do whether I feel like my life's great or whether I feel a little bit down or like what does that kind of navigation look like of kind of where does counseling fit in the context of even following Jesus?
And hopefully I can answer that just by answering the stigma question. Like I think like stigma shows up in two specific areas that both revolve around trust. Whether you grew up in the church or didn't grow up in the church, there's different like shapes and worldviews that exist. And to speak a little bit more in the Christian context, some shapes of Christianity emphasize that and take very literally that like if if God is all powerful, then you only need him. And so therefore the only thing you should do is pray. And maybe like an extreme moment of that in COVID would be this idea of like, well, we'll just only pray and that will respond, that will cure COVID, or whatever that might look like. And so what that ultimately does is kind of instill a value implicitly that if you're going through something, you shouldn't go to another person, because then you're not going to God, which would then mean that you're not living out your faith well. You're not being a good Christian. If you come from a different worldview, it would be, and those pieces are parallel. It's like you're not being a good person for whatever those reasons would be, because there's this emphasis of that you need to trust God, which is not a bad thing. And I'm by no means saying don't trust God, but when it becomes so rigid, it sometimes implicitly, without getting into the nuance of what does that mean, it gets to this place of trusting anyone else means that you're not trusting God. Right. I remember like encountering like this like little anecdote and metaphor of like, someone's stuck on a cliff and they're hanging on for their life and they start praying like, God, help me. And then all of a sudden they like look over and see a vine, but they don't grab it to climb down because they're like, oh, I need God to help me. Or someone comes by and they like offer them a ladder. And then they're like, no, sorry, I can't take that. I'm waiting for God to help me. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the person can't hold on anymore. They fall and die and then go to heaven. And then they're pissed at God. They're like, why didn't you help me? And God's like, oh, I gave you a vine. I gave you a person. Why didn't you take those things? Which kind of emphasizes this idea of trusting someone else and talking to someone doesn't necessarily mean that you're not trusting, God. So there can be a stigma then related to counseling where, oh, you're trusting someone else. You're trusting psychology. That right. must mean that you're not trusting God.
Can you maybe just for a second hone in mm-hmm. on why do you think it is that we're so hesitant to trust people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually think that even like connects to the second point of trusting. Mm-hmm. And this goes to like there's many different shapes of Christianity that teach different sure. things. But oftentimes in Christianity, there seems to be this emphasis that we can't actually trust ourselves or our experiences. Like we're told we're bad. Most of our impulses lead to bad things and we shouldn't trust that. So if we can't trust that for ourselves, why would we trust that to another person who's maybe fallen? Right. And this leads to unintentionally in this idea of like trust and follow God leads to this idea of like, well, distrust other people, distrust yourself. Mm-hmm. And this actually leaves us feeling like very disembodied from ourselves and very disconnected from ourselves. And because of this, like it results in someone feeling bad about themselves, because if you're having an experience, but you're being told your experience doesn't matter, it's not good, you're bad, ultimately that's going to make you feel worse about whatever it is that you're experiencing. And then incredibly isolated, because if you're the person hanging on the cliff and someone comes to help you, there's the sense of, oh, I can't take your hand or I'll be bad. Mm. But that just leaves someone stuck on a cliff, right. which is awful. And I think this also gets propagated a little bit implicitly by like Christian culture of oftentimes, to use the cliff example, it's mm-hmm. someone's hanging off a cliff and someone might yell for help. And we look at that person and say, oh, that seems really hard. You're hanging off a cliff. Like, I'll pray for you. And then we walk away.
Yeah.
Which is just this deep isolation of maybe, I think, and this isn't just in Christianity. I think this is like in Western culture at large, we are taught that life is supposed to be good. Life is supposed to work out for you. Jesus loves you, so things in your life will be good. Why would God want anything bad to happen to you?
Yeah.
And this implicitly says, well, oh, if life is good, pain is bad. I should stay away from pain. Pain's not okay. But I think this kind of undermines Jesus. Like, Jesus cried tears of blood, which no matter what, like, I've never seen someone cry tears of blood, but someone like Jesus is someone well acquainted with pain and can lean into it. And like the mantra of the gospel is like, kind of pick up your cross, like lean into what it means to, like feel deeply with other people for the sake of the other, and for the sake of yourself. So it's these things that I think get missed in maybe these like cliches that come about. Because if anyone mishears what I'm saying, they could hear like, oh, he said not to pray. Don't trust that person. Like, that's bad. We need to pray. Right. Praying's good. And it's like, oh, this conversation actually isn't quite about prayer. It's about pain and like leaning into that. You can pray and get help. And that doesn't mean that you are bad.
Right.
But it's often in like what gets lost in the nuance of these conversations that leads to the stigma and leads to this sense of shame.
Sure. Do you think there's an element, and this might be more personal for me, but do you think there's an element too where this idea of self-sufficiency, that to say, to go to a counselor, to seek out help, to not just kind of pray your way through it, is to say, I can't handle it on my own. It's almost, you know, I remember the first time someone suggested I see a counselor, I was offended because I felt like they were saying, you've failed, so you need someone else to fix you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is deeply true. I think especially more for males. Like, I think research will also indicate that that's more for males, because oftentimes males get told like, you are valuable for what you can do and you need to be strong.
Right.
And we then interpret that. And this actually, I think, transcends for everyone. If you're told that you need to be strong, showing weakness, then means you're not strong. Which is again, part of like this nuanced dialogue of like things that get missed. Like, for example, someone would say, I need to be courageous. I can't feel afraid. But that actually doesn't work, because if everything's normal, I'm not feeling courageous. Like, I'm sitting on my couch right now. I don't feel courage to sit here. But if I was afraid, like if I was afraid that you'd be mean to me on this interview or something, I would need courage to sit here to talk to you.
Right.
And so there's this idea of like, I need to be self-sufficient. I can't talk to someone. I need to be strong. I can't be weak. But this like actually undermines ourselves at our core as like biologically, as like biological people, because even like what we're like learning more and more about like neuroscience is like the part of our brain that like responds to emotions is so deeply connected to the part that relates to like human connection. So if we feel something, the idea of like, you need to figure that out by yourself is like neurologically, like not actually true at all. And in fact, I think most problems that show up for people, when people feel the most psychologically wounded, it's when they feel pain and isolation. Because if we experience pain or experience something bad, but there's someone who's there with us that says, hey, I see you. It makes sense that you feel that. I care about you. I'm so sorry this happened. But we can still be in relationship together.
Right.
Our brain then learns, oh, this was okay. Like, this was scary and hard, but okay, I made it through. We learn our capacity. We actually then build strength. But if there's no one there offering that, if we don't have that sense of support and safety and protection, our brain says, oh, I could actually never I can't experience that because I don't know if I'll be safe. I don't know if I'll be okay. And so then we put up this facade of strength of like, to be strong means to never talk to someone, never show weakness. But really, there's a deep fear there of like, I don't know if I could handle that, which is actually showing a lack of strength. Not to say that people who struggle with that aren't strong, but just
right
in like the anecdote of that.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Yeah, I think that that concept of what strength is and what courage is a really powerful one. You touched on it a little bit, but I think it'd be interesting to talk through the concept of shame. And you kind of touched on, from a Christian worldview, like, you know, we do understand ourselves to be broken and marred by sin, and sinfulness is a reality in our lives. But can you maybe speak to how, you know, how do we walk through sin, shame, brokenness in our lives that maybe we can feel is there, but there's a sense of, you know, it feels too broken and messed up, or it feels too shameful, or if anybody knew, or that kind of thing. How do we kind of walk through that? What's conscious, at least?
And yeah, I think that's an excellent question. This exists a lot in the church. And I think also just exists in our culture, but maybe to even like differentiate and like define shame, and to differentiate that from guilt is, and I'm stealing this from Brené Brown, but she says like, guilt says I did something bad, but shame says I am bad. And shame is so slippery. It's at least in my work, like it's hard for me not to see shame showing up in different manners. Because shame shows up and essentially says like, it says that there's something wrong with me. And there's, if something's wrong with me, like shame's goal is disconnection. If something's wrong with me, I'm no longer worthy of connection, making it actually really difficult to then say, this is what's happening for me. This is what's going on. And with shame's goal being disconnection and shame telling us, oh, there's something wrong with you, you need something more to be loved, we cope with that typically kind of in two ways. One way would be to add something to your life. This idea of like, shame says I'm not good enough on my own, but you know what? I'm good at sports or music or school, or I'm really good at serving at church, or I can people please to help other people not feel bad. And then I'm valued. Then I get love, which is this way of learning. I need to be like this to be loved. And to actually like, I guess, validate some shame. Like our nervous system's goal is to keep ourselves safe. And so like the idea of fight or flight, like if you see a snake, your body's going to react to that. I tell my clients that like emotions sometimes are responses to invisible snakes. Like our brain identifies this could be scary and threatening to me. And so if shame is saying I'm so unworthy of love, I don't deserve connection, I did this thing and that means I am bad, no one will care for me, that is a truly awful thing to feel. So what shame then does to keep ourselves safe from feeling that like awful pain is it shows up and says, you need something more. Go be very strong. And if you're strong, then you won't have to feel the pain of being alone. Shame's goal of like disconnection could also mean like shame could say, oh, if you tried to show up and if you tried to talk to someone, they wouldn't really see you. You should just disconnect, withdraw. It's not worth it. It's not worth trying. And so, the first example of like me plus something to get value, we walk away from those moments oftentimes like thinking quite anxiously, like, what did people think of me? Like, I may have been able to impress them, but I know that that was a lie. Like, they don't actually see me. And oftentimes it leads to more anxious thought. Whereas when we start disconnecting and shame says, I can't be seen, maybe like more like depressive symptoms kick in with that. But the way to work with shame, which is so scary, and to bring this back to courage, is like, and another Brené Brown quote, I think I'm going to butcher it, but like it's something along the lines of like, courage starts by showing up and letting ourselves be seen. And so when shame shows up and it says, I can't be seen, to work with shame, you actually need to bring that into the light. Now, you might need specific relationships that feel safe and trusting, and that's where a counselor could be actually very helpful for someone, because like a good counselor will not be judging you and like give you a lot of space to explore that. And our goal in counseling is to make sure spaces feel safe. Because when we feel safe, we can take a stand, feel more courageous to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And the next part is when we say these things, to actually speak compassionately to ourselves. And this part can be like really tricky in the church, because if you're told you're a sinner and you're bad, to then actually look at the shame and say, like, you're okay. You meant to do well in this situation, or you reacted because you felt hurt. Like you got angry because there was pain there for you. Sure. Like you were just trying to like protect yourself. Like it can be difficult to speak compassionately to yourself, in church culture, I think is sad, because when I think about like Jesus and the woman at the well, it was, right. It was a very compassionate response that he gave of like, I see you and I'm not going to throw a rock at you, right. Rather than, like I could throw a rock at you and I won't, because I see you and I value who you are. Go find love in a meaningful way to you. That's kind of how he sends her off. But oftentimes at church, we emphasize the sin and miss the love. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe parts of it for us is like that it can be hard for us to care well and love for someone else, because it confronts parts of ourselves. Yeah. That can be scary, so we move away from it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you think it is that we maybe... This is not a question we had written down, so I'm kind of going off script, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for it.
But how do we move from that place of maybe operating out of a place of shame? Like, functionally, shame works, at least in the temporary, right? Like,
totally,
I'm the youth pastor. It's easy to get a kid to stop doing something if I tell them how bad it is and how wrong it
is. Totally, yeah.
But how do we start to move from kind of a culture where we're using shame to change people... Mm-hmm. where we allow love to change people? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, that totally makes sense. Yeah. Oh my goodness. I actually feel like that's like the task of our culture, because so much, you can make way more money. And we live in a capitalistic culture, like using fear, like
yes,
scare someone, like watch the news. And if you see more than two good things happen, like send me an email, and like record it. Like I almost won't believe you. And like through research and psychology, we know that like, if you get someone scared and their life feels in danger, that you can get them to do what you want. And this uses like a lower part of our brain. It doesn't use our whole brain. It doesn't allow us to be fully human. It allows us to like live out of like fear or scarcity. And so how do we love people well? I think that's a beautiful question. And, I think it's something that I hope to keep asking myself and learning and growing more. Part of that, I think it's twofold. We need to be able to love ourselves well. I remember in one of my undergrad classes, like, our prof, like started a slideshow with a quote from Augustine that said, like, God, help me know myself more so I can know you. And I put my hand up being like, Josh, you messed it up. Like you got it backwards. Like we need to know God, then we can know ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, no, that's the quote. Like the more that we lean into who we are, how we were created and are able to love ourselves, sure. then we're able to know God and love others. Like, sure. I actually think one of the hardest parts of Christianity is like, I don't know, like it's like if Jesus is truly the Son of God, like it's not the hardest thing to believe that he could rise from the dead. Like you're right. God, it's kind of comes with the gig. You can do what you want. But I think what's harder is to trust this idea that like when God or Jesus looks at you, that you're loved, that when you look at yourself, you see love. Like, and so to really honor and foster our relationship with ourselves is so, so important, to be able to know ourselves so well that when something happens, and we feel an emotion, this energy that moves us inside of us, that we can look at that with like compassion and validation and be like, oh, I felt so scared in that moment. Like I felt angry. I reacted out of anger, but what was happening? Mm-hmm. Oh, this person said that thing and that hurt me. Why is that important to me? Well, I care about this. Mm-hmm. And in like taking care of like all of these different parts of us, like these emotional pieces, honoring the parts of us that are good, mm-hmm. like recognizing our ability, our capacity, and like encouraging ourselves. Like this helps us develop a relationship with ourselves that then makes it easier to respond to other people. Like a well-trained therapist will have done a lot of their own work. Part of that's to like protect the client. But a lot of that too, I think, is just to know yourself, know what comes up for you, be able to take care of that so that you're able to tend well and love other people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you spoke to it really well. This idea of like validating an emotion is not the same thing as validating sin. My counselor said to me once, and I have it written down because I have a hard time functionally believing it on the day to day, that emotions aren't a problem that have to be fixed. Yeah. There's something to be processed. And understanding that there's a difference between maybe the sin I did out of my emotions and being willing to engage the emotions themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's really helpful. That's good.
Yeah.
What about subconscious stuff? One of the things that I've had conversations with people about is these things that come up maybe later in life, especially as we're getting into young adulthood, into our 20s, we're developing as adults, and we go, well, I didn't realize that was an issue for me. Or this thing comes up.
Totally.
And, oh my goodness, I've never struggled with this. Where did this come from? Why do I feel this shame here? Why do I feel scared here?
Yeah.
How do we, like as you're saying, investigate ourselves that we might know God? How do we do that with the stuff that feels so subconscious and like we don't know where it's coming from?
Yeah. I think that actually beautifully connects back to what you were saying about emotions as something that needs to be processed. So I'll answer that by going through emotions, like what we know about like emotion. Oh, you might have lost me for a moment. Am I back now?
You're there.
Okay, cool. What we know about emotions and what emotion theorists talk about is that emotions are learned. Like if a baby's crying, like oftentimes when someone's emotional, like the middle school thing is like, oh, you're being a baby. And we look at that like a bad thing, but to like flip that, let's look at that seriously. Let's say that there was a baby on the couch beside me and it started crying. If I looked at that baby and was like, you're a baby, like figure that out on your own, people would think I'm insane. Because like our response to babies is to move towards them, hold them, soothe them, be like, it's okay, I'm here. Like, what's your need? Do you need your diaper changed? Are you hungry? Like, what do you need? And the baby doesn't know, but we figure that out with them. And that's like any response, any emotional response is different emotions have different needs. And when we know that those needs can be met, we can discover closer to who we are and what's going on for us. So what ends up happening is there will be when like there's unconscious things or patterns forming, we learn over time, kind of like muscle memory. Like one thing I tell my clients is like, if a little kid came in and we said, hey, here's a soccer ball, this is how you kick a soccer ball, and we use their hands to hit the ball, when they go and play a soccer game, they're going to be very confused when they discover, oh, you use your feet.
Right.
And even though they might know that, when the ball comes their way, their body is going to like lunge with their hands. And that's because their body's learned and like their brain has developed neurological pathways to say, ball, hit it with your hand.
Right.
And so we do that with different patterns. I actually had a client right before I got on the phone with you just talk about like anxiously cleaning with their partner. And while they were cleaning, they were like, oh, I remember that like my mom felt a lot of feelings. And when she felt things when I was a kid, she would sometimes then just get mad at me. And so now anytime someone's feeling a feeling, I feel this sense of, I need to make sure that everything's taken care of so I don't get lashed out at. Mm-hmm. And that's actually an example of like, oh, I'm discovering this pattern about myself. So part of that comes with like exploring questions of how are emotions handled? Like, and a lot of this comes from just like part of the task of like young adulthood is discovering who you are and differentiating yourself from the way you grew up to who you want to be. Meeting with a counselor could actually be really helpful to unpack some of those questions. But when we start noticing these things, like to figure out how to heal from that is really difficult on your own, especially when it comes to family things or other important relationships. So I guess to summarize what I'm saying is the way we learn to relate to our feelings and the way we learn to relate to ourselves and other people is learned. And there's so many small moments throughout our lives that get missed. And that's not a bad thing. That's just the reality of life isn't perfect. But to unpack that and to be able to explore that, get more knowledge of it, understand it so that we can hold it and then learn how to then respond to it is really important. So to consider, and we have a bad relationship in our culture to emotions, like being emotional is typically a bad thing.
Right.
But emotions only show up when we care about something. Like if I'm walking down the street and I see you, Dan, and I wave at you and you don't wave at me, I'll be angry. I'll be like, Dan, what the heck?
Right.
But if I see a stranger and wave at them and they don't wave back at me, I'll be like, that makes sense. They don't know me. So why do I care that you don't wave at me versus a stranger? It's not about waving. A rational argument would be like, I either shouldn't feel or I should feel. But the reality is, it's like, oh, my emotion tells me something. I feel more moved when you don't wave at me. Why? And I might be angry at you, but why do I feel angry? Well, I actually care about you. My anger points me to something that I value. I value relationships. I value friendships. And you not waving was this moment of me feeling hurt. And if I can discover, oh, I value the relationship and can hold that, then I can like figure out, oh, how do I express that? Because maybe you don't wave at me and I send you a slurry of text just swearing at you and cussing you out. But that's not actually like honoring my own value. I value the relationship. Why would I yell at you? I might in the moment, but once I discover that, I can learn how to work with that, if that makes sense.
No, that's good. And yeah, I, even kind of on that note, like what's the transition look like from kind of self-discovery to action? Does that make sense? Of that, like, it's one thing to process and to think through, and whether it's, you know, in a counselor's office or with with a community or with a mentor or in prayer or whatever it might be. How and where does that translate to, okay, now here's the action or here's the change or that kind of thing? So it's not kind of shameful behavior management, but actual genuine change.
Yeah. This takes so much practice. Like, this is, like, to use the soccer analogy, this is like practicing not kicking a ball with your hands, but using your feet. And the more you practice this and the more that you can like exercise like new ways of behaving really through compassion, it can be helpful. There's often a dynamic, and this is how slippery shame is that someone will feel like there's an area of their life that they want to improve at. And so they'll try, and every time they fail, they'll say, I suck. I'm so bad at this. This is the worst. And that is shame. That's shame saying, hey, you suck. So there can be this weird cycle of while trying to actually grow, we're actually staying in the same cycle of the shame. So it takes actually catching that and offering self-compassion. It takes, and this is where this actually gets a lot more nuanced, is like this totally depends on the person and what's being worked on. But it takes practice. It takes maybe setting boundaries. It might take like learning to become more aware. It might be like paying more attention to your experience, paying attention to your body, knowing what you feel in your body, which is a weird question, but I ask my clients that probably like 5 times a session. Because our emotions are in our body, and we actually have 9 times more information going from our body to our brain than our brain to our body. So using our bodies and our feelings, that gives us way more information. Even like So in my bachelor's, I was actually more of a communication student than a psych student. And what we know about communication is like more than 90% of communication is nonverbal. Like it's not what we're talking about. So it's kind of insane that the way we try to change ourselves is through this idea of how do I think through things?
Right.
When there's way more information that exists in our body. So to go from self-discovery to change, like it's not so much this step of I've discovered it and now I can change. It's an unfolding process. It actually works in tandem and it keeps growing and changing. Like I feel like I've learned so much of what it means to be a person and how people work. And I think maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, if someone asked me to raise my hand, if I knew people and like knew, if I knew myself, I can go with that. If I knew myself, I probably would have raised my hand and said, yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. And now 5 or 6 years later, if somebody asked me that question, I'd be like, objectively, I think I know myself way more. But I probably wouldn't raise my hand simply out of just knowing, like, there's actually probably a lot that I don't know.
Right.
And I share that just really to touch on this idea of, like, self-discovery and self-growth will help us. It'll help strengthen us, help us feel like we're closer to ourselves.
Right.
And it also leads us to, like, this mystery of, like, life's unfolding. Relationships are unfolding and it's dynamic and I'm growing and I'm changing. And these tools help us navigate the growth and the change.
Right.
But to think that we'll arrive one day is kind of a myth that gets told in our culture.
Right. There's an end point where we're done.
Yeah. You did it. Yeah.
Right. And I think that plays even into our faith and spirituality, where I know for me, right around 23, 24, I hit a wall where I went, okay, well, what's next? Like, I've kind of dealt with all the, you know, the really bad sins, and I have a couple things here and there. But at the end of the day, like, do I just kind of sit around and wait for heaven now? What's the the next 50, 60 years supposed to look like?
And
so that process is actually one of not only personal growth, but spiritual growth in terms of our followership of Christ. One thing I want to talk about just as we kind of come towards the end, and one of the things that maybe I think is a great tension right now is how do we feel out the difference between what is clinical need of professional help, depression or anxiety, or I'm having a tough day, or I'm stressed out this week or this month. Like what is... On a practical note, when do we know when it's time to reach out for professional health? But in general, how do we identify like that this is maybe a pattern in my life or something that really needs some deep work to walk through?
I think that's a great question. And honestly, like a hard one to answer. I mean, to touch on it, like something like depression or something, like if you feel like you have a low mood and feel worthless and like your diet's changed, your lifestyle's changed, the things that you want to do or the things that you were interested in doing, like there's less interest in that. Your personality's changed. Like, and that's been persisting for, so clinically, if that's been persisting for more days than not in a 2 week span, and that deems like a clinician saying like, yeah, this is significantly impairing your life. Like that, according to the book, is like depression. And this is really just like my own personal, so this is not like, this is a viewpoint held in the counseling world, but definitely not by everyone, is I don't actually have a high value on diagnoses because for a lot of the way the diagnoses work is like you need 5 out of 9 symptoms. And so one thing I can encounter is, or I often encounter is like, what if someone has only 4 of the 9 symptoms, but feels those 4 severely versus someone who might have like 8 of the 9 symptoms, but like feels pretty good. And so this is where like the personal judgment part kind of comes in of like, do you feel like this is significantly interfering with your life. If you find that like the support systems in your life, when things come up for you, you're able to talk to them and you feel better and you're able to go back to what normal feels like. If you feel like you're able to keep growing and thriving, then maybe that's a little bit more circumstantial. Maybe that's a bad day and maybe you don't want clinical help. But if you feel really stuck, and if you feel like you're talking to people, and or if you feel like it's hard to talk to people, then a counselor can help you unpack that. If you feel like you're talking to people, but you still feel stuck, like that might be a good time to talk to a professional. And so that piece actually then doesn't, it's not so much about like the severity of your symptoms, because you could be, I have actually seen like a lot of like very successful people with like a house and a family and kids and a white picket fence, and they just crushed it at life, and they've come in being like, Jay, I crushed it. What's wrong with me? I feel so terrible. And so much of our life we are taught like, you're in grade one, the goal is to make it to grade two, then three up until you graduate, and then the next job or whatever it is. And so much of we don't learn, where am I in that? We learn, I just need to like do something. And so seeing a clinician, like to some extent, is ultimately up to you. And you can book consultations with clinicians too. Be like, I don't know if I need to see a counselor. You can talk to a counselor about that, and they can explore with you like what's going on a little bit more to unpack that. Yeah.
No, that's good. And that's something I think, like, even just to speak to, I think sometimes it's, I mentioned earlier this sense of failure in needing to reach out that way. But there's no shame or brokenness in saying, I need help to do that. And I also think there's an element, too, where we have people around us who love us but aren't professionally trained to help us navigate our emotions and get unstuck. And so, you know, we can have friends and relationships and community where we are loved, where we are welcomed, where we are accepted. But sometimes having someone who is a clinician is able to kind of walk us through from a very grounded and objective place as well.
And likely there's a lot a clinician can add input in your life that your friends and spouses or partners can't. And likewise, I tell my clients this of like when they first meet with me is like, I can offer you a perspective that like no one else in your life can, because I'm probably one of the only relationships in your life that is objectively just for you. And that doesn't mean that like I'm better than your friends or your partner, like because you actually need those people to be subjective, to have a personal stake in your life. Like that's actually their role. And so maybe having a counselor, it doesn't mean that you meet weekly. If there's other things you're exploring, maybe you just want a counselor to have that relationship to check in with how life's going. Monthly. I have like, there's a couple I see that comes in like every 3 months just for a check-in. And then there's other people who book with me weekly because they feel like that's what they need to work on. So it very much depends. And yeah, you're right. There's no shame in talking to a counselor, in talking to friends. Like we are biologically, neurologically wired for relationship. Like everything about us speaks to being relational people.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, we're going to close out here, but do you have any last kind of thoughts or words or encouragements you'd want to leave with those listening today?
I think there's one thing that always kind of blows my mind when I first meet a client. It's like I have this moment of, I think the professional word I'm supposed to use is unique. Like therapy is such a unique experience, but like the word I use is weird. Like, oh, you just drove to your house to sit on a couch with me as I sit in a chair, and now you're telling me all about your life. Like, like that is a weird thing, which like brings up like maybe some anxiety or something like that. but this still hasn't shaken me. Every time I first meet a client, I'm just blown away by the courage it takes to show up to your own life, to start asking these questions. So if you notice that things for you feel like they're stirring and it feels kind of scary, know that that's so normal. I think it'd be far weirder if it wasn't scary for you.
Right.
And so if there is a sense of, I guess maybe I just want to encourage people where, like, if they are leaning in towards like this journey of like self-growth and discovery, like, I think that's so courageous and takes so much, willingness to look at your own life, the parts that are good and the parts that are hard. It's being very countercultural to do that.
Right.
And to do that truthfully and honestly. So if that's something that you want to do, good for you. I'm truly and genuinely in awe of that.
That's so good. That's a great place to end. Thanks so much for joining us and for just speaking into these things so kind of openly and vulnerably. And it's been such a joy to have you on. Our Rise Against cover band has a future. I just believe it.
It does. It lives on. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Dan.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to Ajay for being on the Rich YA podcast.